Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 288. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about the Forum, the Colosseum, and the Passeggiata as we return to Rome, Italy. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into the interview, I do have three news stories and one apology. The first, the apology. For those of you who listened to the show when it first came out last week, you may have missed the first few minutes because something went wrong with the recording. I re-recorded that and re-released it in case you missed the three news stories and the announcement that that was the sixth anniversary episode of The Amateur Traveler. And then in news stories, your atlas and your globe are out of date because there is a new country. South Sudan has finally received its independence from Sudan and is the newest country in the world. And then two weird stories about airplane travel. One, a woman was escorted off a U.S. Air flight. Her story is she was escorted off the flight for taking a photo of an employee's name tag because she said the employee was being rude to her. The U.S. Airways story was that she was being disruptive. And then speaking of disruptive passengers, Rock Diaz, an American Airlines passenger, tried to impersonate a soldier to get into first class. There's an easy way to solve this problem. Just send him to Afghanistan. For links to all three of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome the show Andy Steves, who's coming to us from Weekend Adventures. Andy runs tours of Europe, especially for students and backpackers, and we brought him on the show to talk about Rome. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's good to be here.
And I heard you speak recently, and I was interested in what you had to say, specifically as we looked at destinations like Rome, which, of course, is an amazing city to go to. What would you recommend if I'm fresh off the plane and I'm in Rome and I've never been there before, and let's say I have, you know, a week or less, a typical American trip, what should I see?
Well, you're very right, Chris. And just off the plane, you can expect to be overwhelmed and utterly confused. Rome is an incredible city, and it's historically the heart of Western civilization. And my favorite thing about Rome that I've really discovered is they have such an appreciation of their past. They love their history that they don't bulldoze these ancient palaces, palazzi, and piazzas, but rather they just build on top of them. So in this week in Rome, you're going to be walking through some incredible architectural wonders, and your eyes are going to be open all day and all night, just soaking in this culture. That's another great thing about Rome is walking outside on these streets is really walking through a classroom of art history, architectural history, and the Italian culture, and the love of life, the belle figura, and the evening passeggiatas that they all take. And as a tourist in Rome, I'd encourage you to really plug into the local goings-on rather than just shooting from site to site. Of course, do that in the day, but also leave some time for going from each piazza at night and just soaking it all in.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming the first thing I should do is clearly rent a car and drive right into the heart of Rome, right?
Absolutely not. That is the last thing you'd want to do. So going in from either of the two airports in Rome, you can usually take the train or the bus in. And what they'll do is they'll take you straight to the Termini, which is the main train station there. You can also take taxis straight to your hotel or hostel, but that's definitely going to be a more expensive option. On the other hand, the buses and trains will take you straight into Termini. And from there, you should be able to find directions, or you should have been able to find directions from Termini online at your hotel or hostel website.
And as I recall, the main train station is really not that far, a simple walking distance from the Colosseum, the Forum, and some really the heart of ancient Rome.
You can walk, and I've done it many times, but it's not a walk that you'd want to take with bags in hand. So yeah, look into a taxi from Termini, or the two metro lines in Rome cross at Termini. So if your hotel or hostel is on those lines, then you can jump on those. But yeah, you don't want to be walking over all those cobblestone streets with your roller bags. It'll just lead to trouble and headache and soreness the next day.
So we get in, we go to the hostel or the hotel, and we drop our stuff off. Maybe we take a nap, depending on our theory on jet lag. Mm-hmm. And then where would you start someone?
It's a great question. For me, and in my tours, what I do is I kind of organize a weekend or a several-day trip chronologically. So what that means is I like to do the sites of ancient Rome first, and then move through medieval Rome and then to Renaissance Rome. What that means is, first you want to, what I would recommend is, yeah, go see the Colosseum, see the Forum, ancient Roman Forum, as well as the Circo Massimo, which is the old chariot race. And if you've seen Ben-Hur, that's the stadium where they used to race the chariots. And then check out Trastevere, as well as many of the great piazzas across Rome, like the Piazza Navona, Spanish Steps, and Campo di Fiori, and then move along to Renaissance Rome.
Okay, and then let's slow that down a bit. Let's do that in sections here. So we've got ancient Rome. We've got, you said, the Colosseum and the Forum first. Mm-hmm. I think I've seen pictures of the Colosseum. Actually, I've been to the Colosseum. But, mm-hmm. What am I seeing as I go to the Colosseum or to the Forum?
You're taking in, if you really think about it, incredible feats in engineering and architecture completed thousands of years ago. These are guys who did not have cranes, did not have big old machinery, trucks, bulldozers, to move this much sheer mass of rock, stone, marble. If you can go back in history and put yourself as a commoner in Rome or a tourist, Rome is one of the oldest tourist sites in the world. Rome, during its heyday, would have millions of tourists coming through each year to just take in the magnificence of Rome. If you've seen The Gladiator with Russell Crowe, they're not exaggerating. The city of Rome really looked like that. Every single square inch was covered in beautiful marble. And again, it would just be awe-inspiring. So yeah, what you're doing when you visit these ancient Roman sites is really seeing what's left of that today. And I would really encourage everyone to let their imaginations go and just really check into it.
And actually, the one correction I would make there is Romans did have cranes. They had cranes and block and mm-hmm. tackle and actually cement. They had many things that we forgot about for 1,000 years and rediscovered later on in, mm-hmm. in the Renaissance and those periods. But
no stainless steel, though.
Not so much, no.
Or fossil fuels, yeah.
So as I go into the Forum, for instance, what kind of things am I going to see in the Forum specifically?
You're going to see monuments, or remains of monuments. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things to let my imagination go on is the Basilica Constantine. And really, that's just a third of what it used to be. And so if you project from the arches all the way up, you just feel like an ant in this magnificent structure. And to think that, yeah, they made it with wooden cranes and mound power is just amazing to me.
And of course, all of the tourists who are swarming through there gives us a little idea of what the crowds would be, because this was the commercial center of Rome. This is where business was happening.
Commercial, political, religious.
Religious, that's true. Yeah. The Temple of the Vestal Virgins is there, for instance. Right?
Exactly. And to learn about the history of the Vestal Virgins is another very interesting thing. You're right.
Okay. So we went from there. You kind of skipped Palatine Hill and then went over to Circus Maximus. Mm-hmm. Circus Maximus, you mentioned, not a lot to see there in terms of what's actually left, as I recall.
You're right. I just have personal fond memories because I was there during the World Cup in 2008, the finals, which of course happened in Germany, but the local government brought in three Jumbotrons and put them on one side of the hill in Circo Massimo, and there were 300,000 Italians there. And everybody knows how passionate Italians are, but when you make it about the World Cup, the finals of the World Cup, that is surreal. It's something else. It was an incredible experience, that's for sure.
And then you kind of went from there on into, we kind of skip over Dark Ages Rome because there's really not a lot happening. It gets to be a really small city, but you went up into Renaissance Rome, I think.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to be sure to not skip is the Pantheon.
Excellent.
The Pantheon, now that I remember, is another just you cannot miss it. Again, one more incredible engineering feat that the Romans were able to achieve. The Pantheon we see today is not the original. The original was made of wood, and that burned down a while ago. But nonetheless, it is still awe-inspiring to remember that, yeah, these guys were designing new types of lighter cement made with volcanic rock rather than regular stone as the elevation went up as they were building in order to make the higher parts of the dome lighter so as to not collapse on itself.
So we're talking about a building that is a church and has been used as a place of worship back into, I can't quite remember whether it's first century Rome or it's, but it's an old building. We're talking about a 2,000-year-old building here that's still in use, still kept up.
Exactly, exactly. And yeah, the wooden structure was, I want to say, about 100 AD. And then I want to say the stone structure that we see today is, yeah, well over 1,000 years old.
Well, it's even more than that because it was definitely built during the pagan time period. So it predates the Christianization of Rome in the 300s.
Yeah. So maybe it was the stone structure. I got to look that up. And yeah, the reason the Pantheon is still standing today is because it has since been turned into an active Catholic church. We call it the Pantheon, which is not entirely correct. In fact, it's the Santa Maria della Rotonda, which is the actual technical name of it today. The Pantheon, of course, refers to Church of All the Gods. And if you go into the Pantheon, you see all of these nooks where old statues of Roman gods used to be, where you could, it was a one-stop shop to pay homage to all your gods. Pan means all. Theon, of course, means all the gods, or the gods. So what happens then is it's converted into a Catholic church, and for this reason, the popes did not destroy it throughout history. Instead, it's become a very much an active church where you can catch mass in as well.
Mm-hmm. And we say destroy it. Sometimes the churches just simply fell into disuse because no one cared anymore. You know, once people stopped worshiping Mars, nobody was doing the upkeep on the Temple to Mars, and eventually it just fell down, was quite often the case. So the places, for instance, we find in the Forum weren't necessarily destroyed. They just, no one cared, and over time it built up, and you know, as the city got depopulated, suddenly you've just got ruins.
Right. And yeah, and back to the Forum, they used to call it Field of the Giants throughout the medieval ages because the uneducated masses that inhabited Rome at that time could not comprehend who lived there in the past. And so beyond just falling into disrepair, Romans would actually cannibalize these structures, take stones, and use those stones to build their own small houses or structures elsewhere in the city.
Yeah, why go cut fresh stone if there's pre-cut stones just sitting there in the dirt with no particular purpose, as far as you can tell?
Exactly, along with marble and brass as well.
Right. Okay, so we move now up into a little more modern Rome, up into the Middle Ages, or through the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. Where should we see that? Where do you go?
Well, I want to make sure to not skip Trastevere. That's one of my favorite neighborhoods of Rome. That's tangled mess of streets that is so easy to get lost in, but that's really where some of the deeper Roman culture kind of comes out in my experience. That's in Trastevere. But we could also skip over to St. Peter's.
We can go wherever you like here, Andy.
Okay. Let's see. Yeah, St. Peter's and the Vatican Museums, you just can't miss it. And of course, you have the Sistine Chapel there as well. So that's, everybody knows about the Sistine Chapel, painted by Michelangelo during the 15th century.
Okay.
An incredible kind of breakthrough in voluminous painting. Now, instead of just like these 2D paintings that were so prominent throughout Europe in the medieval ages, Michelangelo was leading the way in really creating paintings that looked much more 3D. There was light, there was shadow, there was perspective, there was emotion. Yeah, it looks much more like real life.
And of course, there's nothing that really enhances seeing the Sistine Chapel like being packed in with a bunch of tourists.
Exactly.
That part of the Vatican Museum is where all the crowds gather. People actually race past some amazing things on the way there and just ignore them, like the map room, which I love. Should you go early? Should you go late? How do you not hate the experience, even if you love the art?
Sure. In fact, one of my friends helped me do a tour of the Sistine Chapel. We called it the Pristine Sistine because we got in line really early one morning and just as soon as they opened the doors, ran all the way through the entire Vatican museums. We were going to return to those after, but we wanted to see the Sistine Chapel with nobody else in it. And so they opened the doors of the Sistine Chapel, I think half an hour after the doors of the main museum. So we ran through the museum, got there just in time, and they opened it up to, a room that I had never seen before, a room, the Sistine Chapel, without anybody else in it. And it was pretty incredible. We had it to ourselves with maybe five or six other people for a solid half hour, 45 minutes before the rest of the crowd started, trickling through. And if somebody really wants to make the point of seeing it without anybody else there, I would recommend that. Get up really early, get in line, do your homework, make sure you know exactly when the museum itself is opening. And yeah, run through to see the Sistine. Yeah, eyes on the prize.
Okay. Anything else you would recommend while we're there at the Vatican? I mean, obviously, there's St. Peter's too, obviously.
Yeah, of course. So the Vatican City, of course, is an independent entity apart from Rome called the Holy See. That's the papal country, basically. And in that, you have St. Peter's Basilica, you have St. Peter's Square, you have the Vatican Museum, and the Sistine Chapel, which is a part of the Vatican Museums. One ticket entry gets you into the Vatican Museums and they filter you out or you leave the museum usually into St. Peter's Basilica, or you can if you want to. You just have to keep your eyes open. One thing that I would recommend, it's really cool for me, and I mentioned this on the radio show you might have listened to, but I had the unique chance to see the Scavi, which is the excavations under St. Peter's Basilica. And for me, that was an incredible experience to be able to go beneath St. Peter's Basilica and see what is under there, because...
So that's where they're excavating the older St. Peter's, the one that
exactly.
was...
Exactly. And St. Peter, we tend to forget today that buildings are built where they are for very specific reasons. St. Peter's Basilica wasn't just built there just because they had an open place, an open field outside of Rome. No, St. Peter's altar is over the supposed place where the kind of underground Christians moved St. Peter's body after he was crucified near that spot, like during the halftime of a chariot race. So there used to be a chariot stadium, much like the Circo Massimo, there in the vicinity of St. Peter's, where St. Peter's Basilica is today. And for halftime, the Romans would crucify Christians. And that's where St. Peter's met his end.
Because you really can't beat that for halftime spectacles. So.
Okay. Well, yeah, these guys were tough people back in the day. They had a very much a different take on life, as one could deduce from the reason the Colosseum was built as well, the blood sports. Yeah, so he was moved there, and over time, altar after altar was built, and the church became more and more powerful throughout history, and the St. Peter's we see today is the latest iteration of the Catholic Church on top of St. Peter's tomb.
Well, and actually, as I recall, the raising the money to build that church led to a little
tiff,
kind of kerfuffle up there in Germany with Luther nailing things on the door, so it's that time period that we're talking about when this was built.
Exactly, exactly. They were selling indulgences in order to pay for that big, fancy building. You're right. But the tourists can benefit from it for free today. So not bad for us.
Although we should remember that the dress code as you go in, I suppose, is one thing we should advise people as you're going into any church in Rome, really, is make sure you're not wearing shorts and your shoulders are covered, I think is the general rule?
Yeah, so avoid spaghetti straps. You know, in 110 degree heat in Rome during the middle of the summer, that's hard to remember. So ladies, a suggestion I might have would be to bring a scarf or a shawl in your purse, and you can throw that over as you go through the entrance there in St. Peter's Square.
Although we did see that some ladies were actually being let in who had literally, and I wish I were making this up, put toilet seat covers over their shoulders, and that apparently wasn't considered respectful in a way that I'm not sure that I understand. So
yeah, yeah, I wish we had some pictures of that.
I think you're right that a shawl is probably a little more decorative than than what we were saying.
And respectful, yeah. Some churches will hand out like paper shawls or scarves, but it's tough to depend on that. I've actually seen people being turned away from various churches during my time in Europe. So.
Yeah, no, they will definitely, and especially at St. Peter's, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where would you recommend we go next?
Good question.
We're going to be able to cover everything there is to see in Rome, right?
I studied there in Rome for 4 months during the spring of 2008, and it was an incredible experience for me to be able to spend day after day, week after week in this amazing city. And by the end of it, there were still things on my checklist that I didn't get a chance to do. So,
and I'm willing to bet that wasn't your first trip to Rome.
It wasn't. It wasn't, in fact, because I grew up traveling with my dad, Rick Steves, who would go to Europe each year to update his guidebooks and make new TV shows. He would go to Europe for 3 months, 4 months at a time sometimes, and my family would go and visit him wherever he was in that trip. So by the time I studied abroad myself, I had been to Europe 21 times every summer of my life. But staying in one place was a different type of tourism that I had ever done before.
When you stayed there, when you lived there, what was the thing you saw for the first time and you always wondered, why didn't I see this before? Why didn't I go here before?
Yeah, that's a great question. In fact, the Galleria Borghese, or the Borghese Galleries, to me, are the most, I won't say underrated site in Rome, because there's no way to underrate these. It houses the most incredible collection of paintings and Baroque sculptures that I've seen in my life. And the reason that I would say that they're not seen or appreciated as much as they should be is because it's a small museum and you need reservations to get there. So tourists just don't know to plan that out in advance. But that's something I would definitely say you need to see if you go to Rome.
Excellent. Let's do the opposite. What do the guidebooks recommend that you see that you don't know why people waste their time there?
In Rome, there's not too much that shouldn't be seen. Personally, and this is my own personal opinion, but Castel San Angelo was a bit underwhelming. It costs money to get into. You walk up through this tower. You do have a nice view of Rome at the
top. This is the tower right next to the Vatican?
Right. Believe it or not, the Catholic Church, well, I guess it's easy to believe, but the Catholic Church and the Pope had many enemies during the Middle Ages, and several times they were attacked, and the Pope would need to run into Castel San Angelo, which was kind of like the Alamo of St. Peter's. And that's where, in fact, the Swiss Guard kind of proved their mettle as they defended the Pope running into his last stand in Castel San Angelo.
Well, and for movie fans and Dan Brown fans, it was also featured in
Angels and Demons.
In Angels and Demons, right.
I've read the Da Vinci Code, of course, but not that one.
Oh, that's actually a better one, I think, but, you know, that's just me.
I got to do some homework,
Okay.
But for personally, it was underwhelming. I just didn't get as much out of it as so many other sites. And if your time is restricted in Rome, that would be on the bubble. That would be something to cut.
Okay. There are, I don't know how many different churches in Rome. People obviously go to the Vatican. They go to St. Peter's. But what's the one that you actually thought was more interesting?
It's a great question. Remember, the Pantheon is also a church. That's a great one to see. And I really enjoy Santa Maria del Popolo, another great Baroque church right off of the Piazza del Popolo towards the north of the city. Features many beautiful Baroque paintings, especially Caravaggio's Crucifixion of St. Peter. Mm. And that's an incredibly dramatic painting. The lighting is amazing. And of course, it's free to get into.
And that's featuring the painting where it was originally intended to be, rather than in some museum someplace.
Yes, exactly. And it's important to remember that art is the manifestation of those with the most money at that time and that point in history. Mm-hmm. So in other words, churches housed many of the state-of-the-art painting techniques by the most famous painters at the time, because the church simply had the most money. And so beyond just going to the biggest churches in any given city, I would recommend stopping to smell the roses and pop into any church along the way, because it's a welcome break from the heat of the day outside, as well as a potential gold mine in what you'd find. You can find some incredible paintings and sculptures in these churches wherever you go, throughout Rome and throughout Europe in general.
And then, speaking of stopping to smell the roses, you mentioned Campo di Fiore, the Field of the Flowers, which is nothing of the sort anymore.
Not anymore, yep.
And the Spanish Steps and some of the public spaces. Why would I go there?
That's a great question. For me, a lot of Italian culture happens after the sun goes down. Remember, don't just get up and see the main sights and get exhausted by 4 in the afternoon, eat dinner, and go to bed. Be sure and save some energy for an evening walk with some gelato halfway through. I would be sure to, for one evening during your stay in Rome, connect the dots between the main piazzas of Rome. That would be Campo di Fiori, Piazza Navona, the Pantheon, and Trevi Fountain and the Spanish Steps.
And you mentioned a walk. I believe in Rome we're talking about a passeggiata.
Passeggiata.
Really more of a stroll, isn't it? And out to see and be seen.
Exactly, yeah. I couldn't have said it better myself. To see and be seen is such an important part of Italian culture. Everybody takes their appearance pretty seriously over there, and I'm not one to complain. The people do look pretty nice.
So you're saying that possibly to blend in and fit into the Roman culture, I shouldn't be wearing my Hooters t-shirt?
Don't wear your Hooters t-shirt. In fact, try and leave your North Face jacket at home as well. White tennis shoes and shorts are generally no-nos over there. So, in fact, shorts are considered a boy's thing to wear, a little boy's thing to wear. So as soon as young men enter into adulthood, you don't see them wearing shorts unless they're wearing their Dolce & Gabbana briefs on the beach in order to catch some sun.
And I'll admit that the white shoes is the one thing that I am guilty of that one. I don't own a Hooters t-shirt, just to be fair here.
Okay. Fair enough.
What's the best day you've spent in Rome?
The best day, I would say, if it was my first time in Rome, definitely the Colosseum Forum. Take in ancient Rome, eat lunch near the Pantheon, go back to your hostel or hotel for a nap, and then have some of the best pizza I've ever found in Rome in Trastevere, just off of Piazza Trilussa.
And just over the Tiber River, which is what the name means.
Just over the Tiber River, exactly. Yeah, so Trastevere means on the other side of the Tiber, exactly. And wander those streets, get some gelato, and then do that passeggiata across Rome. And you'll really see the entire city where many of the tourists have gone to bed and the real Romans are out on their strolls with their sweethearts and just taking it all in.
Okay. Any single day of the year you would recommend people be in Rome?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay.
The national holiday is pretty cool. It's either in July or August, I believe. But the national holiday, much like our July 4th, it features parades, jets flying overhead with green, white, and red smoke tailing behind them, and sights of the amazing Berlusconi with his entourage. But that's a great day to be in Rome, but it's also busy. Easter is another time. I was in Rome for Easter just this last April, and Rome is already chaotic. Factor in millions of tourists, like literally millions of tourists there for that particular weekend, and it's almost unbearable. I actually ran a tour there with 40 students in tow, and I survived, but that's just because of my experience and my ability with my language skills with Italian. But that is an incredible experience that you won't likely forget anytime soon. And remember, if you happen to be Catholic, if you ask your local parish for Easter Mass tickets, they are free and they should be able to get them for you. So if you ask far enough in advance, you should be able to attend Easter Mass in St. Peter's Square.
Excellent. When I go to Rome for the first time, what's going to surprise me?
I think the constant noise, smells, and just chaotic nature of the entire city. The Italian people are very expressive, and the Romans especially. They've grown up with a very unique sense that they are the reason the Western civilization exists, and they take great pride in it. You'll see people with tattoos of Rome across their arms, or SPQR, which stands for the Senate and people of Rome. That was a tagline of the Roman Empire. And yeah, what I would encourage is just to not be turned off by this, but rather be open to the garish nature of the city. And if you can take it all in, and if you can thrive in it, you're going to have some incredible experiences and meet the most interesting people who have a great love of life and just really are doing it right. The Italian dolce vita, as they always say. Definitely do your best to don't judge this chaotic nature of the city, but take it all in and see if you can run right with them, you know.
Who's the most memorable local that you've met there?
I can tell you right away, Mickey of Michelangelo's Michelinia. Mickey owns a Mickey is his nickname. Michelangelo is his full name, and he owns a store called Michelinia, a student pub sandwich bar. And he has since developed it into attracting a upscale crowd, actually. And it's directly behind the Pantheon, just kitty corner from the Pantheon. And during my time in Rome, that's one of my first stops. I always go in for a sandwich and just to catch up with him and his son and his fun-loving crew that work at his restaurant. I could keep going. I love the guy. One day I was eating lunch after class in Michelinia, and he comes up to me and asked me what I'm doing the next day. And I was like, well, I don't really have any plans. What's the story? And this is all in his very strong Roman dialect. And after 3 or 4 years of studying Italian, I still have a hard time really understanding it. But he asked me if I would like to go in for the Swiss Guard induction ceremony inside the Vatican City the next day. And I responded, well, let me push some things around. I'll see what I can do. But no, of course, I went and saw the Swiss Guard induction ceremony inside the Vatican City. So that was really cool. And I got to stand next to some really high-powered people in military uniforms. And it was just an incredible experience. And because I made friends with him during my time in Rome, I had that unique opportunity to go and see that.
Okay. Now, I'm a photographer. What's the best picture you've taken, and where were you in Rome?
There's not even one place to say. There's so many different places. I would recommend people, a great viewpoint is the Gianicolo, which is a hill kind of between the Vatican City and Trastevere on the far side of the Tiber. It overlooks the entire city, and there you can have some beautiful panoramic shots of Rome. Also, daily markets throughout Rome offer some great perspective, some bright colors for the amateur photographer. Also, definitely go in for the detail on the ancient stones of the Colosseum, the Forum, and any one of the many ruins throughout the city. So you'll have no shortage of pictures to take while you're in the city.
One of the places that I like, you talked about zooming in for the details, is Trajan's Column.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which the whole column tells a story. And so you can take a picture, you can stand back and take a picture of the whole column, and it just is a column. But if you zoom way in, you get to see much more of the daily life scenes of, this used to be a market, as I recall, in ancient Rome when Trajan was emperor. So yeah, some of those are really fascinating. Or when you zoom in, for instance, on the Arch of Titus, you can see that Titus had defeated the Jewish revolt, and so you can see them marching away with the menorah from the temple if you take a detailed shot there.
Exactly, and that menorah actually happens to be the oldest depiction of the menorah, right? That happens to be the oldest depiction of a menorah. Am I right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I can look it up, but anyways, we can keep talking. But that is a very remarkable piece, actually, so...
You talked about it being noisy. Any warnings you would give before somebody goes to Rome? Or Roma. We haven't really talked about it with the real Italian name there, but
exactly, Roma. Get ready to play chicken with cars as you're crossing the street. You need to kind of build up your confidence, stick with whoever you're traveling with, and do not stop. These Roman drivers will keep going until they see you commit to going, and then they'll stop. They're some of the best drivers in the world, but also the most hectic, and it's the most frenetic traffic I've ever witnessed.
Well, that's one of the reasons I was joking about renting a car and driving into town.
Exactly.
I've driven out of town from the train station, and I will never do it again.
It's something else. It's something else.
Navigating, for one thing. Just,
and I would also say, don't even try to rent bikes to get around the city of Rome. In other cities, I'd say go for it.
Sure.
But in Rome, there's so many cobblestones. Traffic is like just beyond navigable for any outsider. So stay on the feet. And anytime you cross a street, just remember that they're going to stop if they see you stride out confidently. It's all about confidence and making sure you get eye contact. And so that's something that is an acquired skill for sure.
Yeah, no, I think a firm belief in the afterlife is really necessary to cross the street in Rome. So,
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
As we start to wrap this up, you mentioned one particular eatery. You'd mentioned Michelangelo's place. Any other places, bars, eatery, night spots that you really recommend to people?
Yeah, that's the thing. With Rome, if you look at a map, the streets are so squiggly, topsy-turvy that I'd really have a hard time. I could tell you a few places, but it's really a matter of going out, being open to new things, and finding your own restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
A formula I like to use as I'm trying to find a restaurant is avoiding touristy tracks between, say, the Colosseum and the Pantheon. Go a couple blocks off of that and avoid the checkered red and white tablecloths and avoid the menus that are posted in six different languages on the front door.
I think the only bad meal we had in Rome was, you're right, just across the street from the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew they were going to get people whether or not they did a good job. So
exactly. Because those restaurants subsist on the tourists who are coming in once. Yeah. They'll pay more and then they never see them again. What we need to do is find the restaurants that are supported by locals and people who return time and again. So those are the restaurants we want to find. And yeah, just keep your eyes open. Anytime you go into a restaurant and you don't hear a word of English, that is your restaurant. Go in there, sit down, and enjoy your meal, because I promise you it's going to be much better than one where you hear English and German.
Okay. Last three questions. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Rome.
One thing that makes me laugh and say only in Rome is the street crossing right across from the Vatican. Actually, there's a blind corner that is between the most delicious gelato and the exhausting day-long Vatican Museum experience. And it's a blind corner in which you just gotta run for it. And the near-death experiences I've had there time and again are what makes me laugh and say only in Rome.
No, you're sure that's not why the gelato tastes particularly good?
That could definitely play a part. That could definitely play a part, for sure.
And finish this sentence. You really know you're in Rome when what?
You really know you're in Rome when you're walking down the street and you catch the scent of fresh Roman bread, basil, and mozzarella. You really know you're in Rome when you sit down and have all that placed right in front of you in a fresh, classic Roman pizza.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize Rome, the eternal city, in just three words, what three words would you use?
I got two: lovable chaos.
Okay.
Lovable chaos and a unique love of life and self-expression that you just won't get anywhere else, with the hands, with the language, the sing-song nature of the Italian language. So yeah, lovable chaos and a love of life of the people who live there.
Okay. I believe you may have gotten more than three words, but we'll let you get by with that.
I didn't do so well in haiku class.
Yeah. Andy, thanks so much for coming on the show. If people are interested in more about what you're doing now and the tours that you're leading, especially targeting college students and backpackers mostly at this point, where can they find out more information?
Yeah, check us out. My name is Andy Steves, and the business I run is Weekend Student Adventures. Check us out online at wsaeurope.com. And what we do is cater to budget-minded backpackers and American students studying abroad in Europe who have three-day weekends. We put together weekend packages for the student who has three-day weekends and wants to make the most of their time overseas.
And I'm gathering you're doing most of your tours are walking tours, not the big bus tours?
Correct. So we put together weekend packages in cities across Europe. So Rome, Paris, Prague, London, Dublin, and Barcelona, among others. And our tagline is enhance your semester abroad, show up at the hostel, and we'll take it from there. So students book their own travel, meet us in Rome or Prague, etc., and We include the hostel, food, walking guides, museum entries, and even bike tours sometimes.
But not in Rome, yeah.
But not in Rome, correct.
Excellent. Well, Andy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It was a pleasure.
In News of the Community, I had asked in a blog post about what people's favorite episodes, or at least favorite episodes, were of The Amateur Traveler. I did hear from Michelle, who is writing from Northampton, Massachusetts, and said her favorite episodes were a couple done on South America, Peru, Guatemala, and the really long one on Argentina. That was the first, I think, two-part episode on The Amateur Traveler, because my guest just knew so much that that show was going to be very long if I did it in one piece. And also the one on Greece. Now, I think there have been three on Greece, so I'm not sure which one Michelle is talking about. Fred Lusk, who's been a guest on the show, is catching up on older episodes and listened to the episode on Portland and added these comments. Powell's books is worth a full afternoon, if not all day, and our last trip we went twice, enough said. On the south end of Forest Park, mentioned in the episode, is the much more developed Washington Park, which is the home to several things worth seeing. On top of my wife's list was the International Rose Test Garden. Roses are her favorite flower. Even though we missed the peak rose season, she was very impressed. The Japanese garden is outstanding. We didn't have time to visit the zoo, one of my favorite things to do, but it looked to be top-notch. Washington Park is about a mile downtown of Portland, and we will spend more time there on our next visit. On Saturdays, there are several craft fairs all within walking distance of downtown. The whole thing is called Saturday in the Park. In my humble opinion, Portland's best day trip is the Columbia River Gorge, immediately east of the city along Interstate 84. First stop should be Crown Point Vista House State Park. The views from there are outstanding. Heading east are dozens of waterfalls ranging in size up to the renowned Multnomah Falls, 640 feet in two beautiful drops. Some of the waterfalls are drive to, some require a short, easy stroll, and some require a real hike. If you're a waterfall fan like me, I live 90 miles from Yosemite Valley. This is the main reason to go. However, you can also visit Bonneville Dam, see the windsurfers, etc. Number four, if you continue to the Hood River to spend the night, you can complete a two-day loop around Mount Hood via Highways 35 and 26. It's a beautiful hike. You can do it in one day, but I recommend at least two. And Fred has four more recommendations, but I'll let you check out the Portland episode to see those. And then similarly, we heard from Gabriel Agaguga on the comments about the Normandy episode, and he had a number of things to say, but I wanted to read one in particular, his comments on Mont-Saint-Michel. The interior is desolate. It must have been one of the most desolate, non-ruined Christian sites I visited, thanks to this thing called the French Revolution, so be prepared. The village at the foot of the Abbey of Mont-Saint-Michel is a tourist trap. It only has restaurants, shops, and museums with animatronics. If you had time, you should drive to Mont-Saint-Michel at night and visit first thing in the morning. Mont-Saint-Michel is lit at night, so it looks like Disneyland. And it's lit throughout the night, probably paid for by the French state, so you can take your time getting there. And you can check out the rest of his comments on the Normandy episode. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. And I'd like to thank all of the kind wishes that I had after announcing that it was the 6th anniversary of the show last week. If you have any comments on this episode, feel free to leave them at amateurtraveler.com or drop me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.